Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. I'm Donna Sebo, and we have got a phenomenal program for you today. Now, today we're going to be dedicating this show to a subject matter that is so important, I think, to American business. But it's not just the business person. It is a subject matter that touches every aspect of life, period. What is that? It's integrity. It is being able to walk the walk of honesty in business. The subject matter we're going to be talking about is Innovation Corrupted, the Origins and Legacy of Enron's Collapse. My guest today is Malcolm Salter. And Malcolm, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, you have been at the Harvard Business School. You're the James J. Hill Professor of Business Administration Emeritus.
Correct.
You spent 5 years of your life, and correct me if I'm wrong, in putting this material together. It is incredible the amount of detail and information that you were able to put into a format that is readable by a layperson, by myself.
Well, you're nice to say, you know, over this 4 or 5 year period, more and more information began to trickle out. There was some very good reporting at the front end by the major journals, the Times, New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times. But then there was a lot of millions of pages of testimony before Congress. There were a variety of court demanded documents, really, that came out through the trials. There were reports that were vast reports that were requested by the creditors in their suits. So there was a lot of data that trickled out over a period of time.
I don't know how you got through it all. I probably would have been brain dead after.
It was a passion of mine because this book was not only it's not only a book, but it's sort of a bookend for me.
Mm-hmm.
A bookend in the sense that I've been teaching for 40 years, and it sort of put together, allowed me to pull together so many different themes that I've been working with over the years: strategy, organization, governance, ethics. And it was all here for me to look at and to try to think about.
Yes, and I think you'll probably be using it in your environments of teaching.
Absolutely.
For a long time and passing it along to other people. It seems like every generation has to have something like this to remind them
right. Of
certain principles. Now, this collapsed. Enron collapsed in the fourth quarter of 2001.
Right.
What was it primarily all about? What was Enron? Who was Enron?
Well, let me just go back to the title that's so interesting. You know, Enron was an extraordinarily innovative company. And that's why, you know, the title of the book, Innovation Corrupted, has a strong Miltonic lilt to it, if I can say. You know, John Milton's famous epic poem, you know, Paradise Lost.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a very, very innovative company at the beginning. It was an O-line pipe company, and they basically decided to become to create a market for a commodity, which happened to be natural gas, which had a highly inefficient distribution system. And they were able to ensure reliable delivery of natural gas throughout the country by wiring together a portfolio of suppliers and building a diversified portfolio of contracts from which to select the best solution for a customer. So, for example, if you're a hospital in Chicago and you want to get energy needs for 10 years in the future, and you want to get so much gas and so much oil or whatever it is over a period of time, rather than going to a variety of sources, you were at various different points of time, you could go to Enron and write an energy contract that would go out for 10 years and have it delivered basically through pipelines to your doorstep. This had never been done before. And Enron was able to do that because basically it had its own relationship with suppliers of gas and was able to inventory that gas and hedge it so that they didn't take a price risk. And they did a lot of interesting things along the way, including physical logistics. But one of the most important things that they did was to create an online trading platform called Enron Online, which meant that both commercial players and retail players could basically get contracts for any period of time, for 6 months up to 20 years, and it was all done electronically. And within the first year of its creation, it was the largest e-commerce operation in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Enron was able, within the first year, to be basically, you know, responsible for trading 25% of the nation's natural gas contracts.
That is a huge corner.
And then they added on, electricity. And then from that, they went to broadband and they went to water. And this is where they began to get into problem. But before the fraud or the alleged fraud ever was created, they made some bad business decisions. Now, I have to say that there's nothing illegal about a bad business decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right? It's sort of risk and return. But basically, they had a very highly innovative model for one segment of the of industry, natural gas and energy. And they tried to apply it to energy, and it worked in energy, but not as well. And then they applied it to water and to broadband, and it didn't really work at all. And they lost a lot of money. And then they began to try to, after 1997, which was their first down year in profitability, they began to take a lot of the contracts and a lot of the assets that were related to these less successful businesses and move them off the major balance sheet into what they call off-balance sheet partnerships, which had private investors. And basically, according to various different accounting rules, they could get it off the balance sheet and then therefore didn't have to account publicly for the decline in prices of contracts that had gone bad or the decline in assets, physical assets that had gone bad. And that was really the beginning of the trouble, 1997. Although the roots were really laid very, very early.
I would say so, from what I read.
And one of the roots was that something that I know will interest you, Donna, is that this was an organization from the very beginning that had trouble with truth-telling.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to 1989, the first scandal that they had after a merger that created Enron was a trading scandal in a town with a wonderful name called Valhalla, New York. And this was a basically the traders were keeping two sets of books because they had such enormous incentives, which was another problem we can get into, basically to lie and cheat so they could get their bonuses. And this was discovered, and through very comical ways that I can tell you about if you're interested. But rather than revealing this, Ken Lay at that time, the CEO and chairman of the company, rather than revealing it, basically sent his star trader up from Houston to try to earn back a lot of the losses that had been disguised with these two sets of books. And as a matter of fact, the star trader did earn back a lot of the losses, that had been disguised. And so they didn't have to, what they reported, didn't basically hammer the stock or ruin their credit rating in any way. But everybody in the organization knew that this had been covered up. And then again, since there was no real punitive damage, certainly no public punitive damage to the individuals involved, they did it again.
Mm.
And the second time the feds came in, and of course then they went to jail.
All right, now let's look at a few numbers here. When they started, they grew from $13.5 billion in 1991
right.
to $101 billion 10 years later.
Correct.
And during the last 5 years, they delivered more than 500% total return to shareholders. I mean,
right.
That is an astronomical percentage.
Absolutely.
And I can imagine why people wanted to get on the bandwagon. My goodness.
Well, I think they did. And the real question was, were those numbers real?
No, they weren't. We know that they weren't.
And a lot of those numbers, had to do with the way in which they accounted for profitability. One of the things that was so intriguing about this company was this was a company with a lot of profits, but no cash.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that happen? Well, it has to do with how you value the profits, the future profits of contracts that have been written during a year. So if you've got a 20-year or a 12-year contract and you're taking, you're sort of estimating the profitability and then running it through your income statement, that may or may not come true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then, of course, when that happens, then what you have to do is mark down those assets if the profits are not really in fact generated, and then you have to have these massive write-offs. Well, they went bankrupt before they had these massive write-offs. And the reason why they had the write-offs, why they went bankrupt, were they were basically a trading company. And at the first whiff of any malfeasance in a company, a trading company, your counterparties, your trading parties, disappear to the woodworks. They cancel contracts on you like mad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically why it fell so quickly.
You bring out, right in the beginning of your book, that at the core of this whole mess, the core, is about thoughtless and incompetent leadership,
right,
the ethical drift that, and I'm using your exact words, inevitably
right,
followed, and a breakdown in the oversight and control by the company's board of directors and external watchdogs.
Correct.
Now, I can just imagine those people that invested...
That's the perfect storm, Donna.
Yeah, I mean, that invested this. Can you imagine if you were sitting in their place and all of the money, their retirement, everything that they had was in this because they believed in this. They believed in the numbers that were there. All of this is gone. Everything that's supposedly making them multimillionaires.
Oh, yeah.
And now they've got 10 cents.
Right. If that,
right, and it's horrifying, and there's no place to go because this is such a huge bankruptcy. No place to go.
Yeah,
now,
$60 billion in value destroyed.
I mean, it is just something that you wonder how these people can even sleep at night. But we won't go into that. You say it also involved the corruption of a remarkable strategy of innovation.
Right.
Which is what we started off with.
Correct.
And it was the result of a gradual erosion of integrity and candor that took place in response to a combination of factors.
Right.
You will talk about Andrew Fassel, and he created the first sheet of misinformation.
Right.
And you said there were so many careless mistakes that you wonder about this. Because of the information you have in your book, outside advisors, investment bankers,
right,
they were mixed up in this, they covered things up, greed.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. There's, let me just say a word about Fastow. Fastow is really the true villain in the story.
Mm-hmm.
He, of course, plea bargained with the government, and was given 10 years, but because he did so well at Skilling's trial, he was only sentenced for 6 years. Jeff Skilling, it should be pointed out, who decided to defend himself, got 24 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting. You plea bargain and you get 6, and you try to defend yourself and you get 24.
Mm-hmm.
That's like third degree murder. Well, some people think he deserved to get that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably will be reduced on appeal, but still it will be significant. The rest of his life is really destroyed and
mm-hmm.
will be in jail.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that's so interesting about the Enron case and all those things that you tick off, which I write about, is that, and why it is such a marker case, is not only because of the lack of oversight, and not only because the watchdogs, many watchdogs didn't bark, which we can talk about. But much of the alleged fraud in Enron is not incontestably illegal.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean is that men and women of wisdom may differ in different jurisdictions of the court as to whether or not a particular act is illegal. It may be devious in some way, but it may not be a violation
mm-hmm.
you know, of code.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to make a list of all of these, you know, in the book. And I give examples of innovative management. I give some examples of inept management. Then I have this long list of sort of devious management practices, which are sort of legal close calls where responsible parties, you know, will differ about the legality and the prospects for successful prosecution. And then my fourth category is fraudulent management. And, you know, that list actually is pretty short. It's really out of Fastow's guilty plea,
mm-hmm.
which was basically lying.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this alleged conspiracy by senior executives to conceal the company's true financial position. I actually feel there was a misrepresentation of material fact, and therefore there was fraud by senior management.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear to me that there was a conspiracy. I have to say that. I think it's a more subtle sort of psychological process than that. But what's so interesting about this, there's so many things that were on the line. This was the ultimate gaming strategy, you know, where people were gaming accounting and SEC rules. And that really is, and why this is a market case, is that this is really sort of the dark underbelly of 21st century American capitalism. And I'm a staunch capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that we, and because we're a rules-based society, more than we are a principles-based society when it comes to finance, that everybody hires their lawyers and everybody hires their accountants to figure out how close we can get to maximizing our own self-interest without crossing the line into something that's illegal. So that's very dangerous. That's very dangerous territory to live in. And that's sort of in the murky borderlands of the law. And this is where Enron lost their way. And this is where the watchdogs didn't really see very clearly what was going on.
Well, something that really grabbed me right at the very beginning of your book, and I'm sure it would grab anybody else,
mm-hmm.
there was a, using your words, I'm quoting exactly from your book, there was a run on the bank.
Well, that's what Skilling said, there was a run on the bank.
Yes. And he and Lay, together,
yep.
ended up with $178 million and $78 million, respectively, from sales of the stock and exercised options during 2000 and 2001.
Yeah, the,
and they had
the 18 months before the collapse, right?
Yeah, they had cashed out other gains earlier.
Correct.
Now, when you do something like this, that we're not talking about $100,000 or $200,000. We're talking about millions of dollars
right.
out of, you know, a company that's worth billions. I mean, when I saw that, I thought, how in the world could they say that they didn't know what they were doing when they did that? You cannot have that big a chunk, and correct me if I'm being ignorant, but
right.
that much money going out?
Well, there are two different issues here. In terms of the amount of money that they were able to cash out, you know, in terms of the stock, that's a function of that the stock price was totally overvalued, way, way overvalued. They probably knew that it was way overvalued.
Sure.
But, and so they cashed out on that. And there's certainly, you know, when the numbers get that large, you know, then what you want to do is you want to, and when you get a stock price that is so overvalued, what do you want to do? You want to support the stock price, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's when you really begin, you know, as a management team, you know, pushing the outside of the envelope. For example, let me give you a case in point. Skilling at one point earlier turned the tax department into a profit center.
Now, how in the world could he turn a tax department into a profit center?
Well, that's the question. And what signal does that give? A tax department, what that says to the tax department is, you go out and figure out a way to save us tax dollars, okay? In other words, to contribute cash flow to the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what a tax department is supposed to be doing. The tax department is supposed to be, first and foremost, advising the corporation on compliance.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sends a signal out. And therefore, when they began also to begin to move a lot of these bad investments and contracts off balance sheet and all the self-dealing that was involved in that, that was all in the way of trying to manage the earnings and support the stock price of the company. And that's really where the excesses came in. And the costs, to everybody of that stock price falling were so high that they would try to bend every rule to keep their credit rating up and to keep the stock price up. Credit rating was very important because they borrowed a lot of money to inventory contracts.
Now,
so there was a motive behind this, and the motive was that they misrepresentation material fact. They misrepresented the true financial position of the company. Most people did not see this, except for the short sellers in the market. The stock price, you know, went up. A lot of people cashed out, but they had to perpetuate it over a period of time, else they would have lost their credit rating, and the whole house of cards would have collapsed. And that's where they began taking all the risks that they did. And many of those risks turned out to be fraud.
There was also the issue with the board.
Correct.
Now, here is a board of this very innovative company that is worth billions of dollars, according to the book.
Yeah.
And these are not uneducated individuals.
It's the star board. It's the star board.
Yeah, they just, there were all kinds of red flags. If we have time, we'll talk about some of those red flags.
Right,
but what, you know, those red flags. Yes, I mean, and they're not held accountable. I thought a board was to be held accountable.
Well, there's several aspects to it. One is perhaps a psychological one, okay, which is that, you know, the rock stars were Skilling and Lay, and the board, that you could call the directors, you know, basically, you know, their followers. That's not what a board should be. As a matter of fact, the CEO and the chairman and the CEO ought to work for the board, not the board working for the CEO. But let me just, so that is probably one thing that was going on. There's some probably other things that were going on as well, which was that this was a very complicated company. Most people didn't understand derivative finance. The financial technology was very, very difficult to understand. So there's a warning there, which is if you don't understand the business, you shouldn't be on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that there was a certain, you know, they probably got lulled into a certain, you know, optimism and self-confidence that the management had. Let me just say, and this is an important point, in the class action suit brought against the corporation by shareholders, with the lead claimant being organized the University of California Region Board of Regents, the directors were never basically sued for breach of fiduciary duty. Which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They were never sued for a breach of fiduciary duty, and I spent about a year looking into this. And I think it was proper that they would. I don't think they ever did actually breach their fiduciary duty, mainly because the standards of fiduciary duty are relatively low for policy reasons. Because if they're too high, no one would want to be a director because the costs are too high, the risks are too high.
Mm-hmm.
So while, and this is my judgment, so while the board did not violate in any sense that I can see legal standards of fiduciary duty, I do see that they violated the values underlying the law of fiduciary duty. So I see sort of a moral breach, not a legal breach here,
mm-hmm.
which I think is what you're getting at. And the question is, how could that happen? How could they not see that? And that is, it's a bit of a conundrum. For example, Donna, if I said to you, okay, in the summer of 2000, you're a director of Enron, we're going to sell $8 billion worth of assets to a Kuwaiti investment group. You might ask, as a director, why are we selling $8 billion?
Mm-hmm.
You know, of assets. And we wanted to do it fast, and we wanted to do it in the summer of 2000. Well, the answer to that is maybe we need cash, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we're cash short. And so why that didn't ring a lot of bells, I have no idea. And I can go on and we can talk about that. Or in the summer of 2000, the board was told that $27 billion, or 50% of Enron's assets, you know, were off the balance sheet. I mean, isn't there a limit when you begin to, you know, kind of behave like Khrushchev, take your shoe off and bang it on the table and say, what's going on?
Well, it would make, yes, I mean, the fact that you would be
right.
told that in a meeting, and
right.
then you would not ask a question saying, excuse
right.
me, how much is not being shown on the books?
Right.
Something's
so I think
wrong.
I think that there's nothing here that the board did that I can see that is in any way illegal. They were all, now, the other thing that's a problem here is board process. That, to me, is the real kind of villain here. If you look, you'll see in my appendices, not all board minutes were revealed. But if you look at them, if you look at the ones that have been revealed in congressional testimony, and you look at the agenda of the various committee of the boards, and you look at the subjects on the agenda and the amount of time that was spent, there's no way they could cover those in any depth, Donna. So you look at all the, you know, the 15 agenda items and they're meeting for 90 minutes. It would take 2 days to go through
mm-hmm.
that in any depth.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the problems, and this takes it away from the fault of the individual directors and more to the process that was in place, was that they had governance processes of an old line industrial firm, simple business, simpler business, than the processes that were required for a very fast moving, you know, financial services
mm-hmm.
firm, which is what they become. And these poor processes basically torpedoed them, in my judgment.
You have the board, you have Skilling, you have Lay, and he died 10 days after he was indicted, I believe.
Convicted.
Oh, convicted, excuse me.
Yeah.
Arthur Andersen, the company,
right.
which was one of, what, the big six in
great
the
firm.
United States?
Great firm.
And they had to close their doors because they didn't do their job.
Well, that's a complicated issue. You know, first of all, there was conflicts of interest here in a non-traditional sense. So many of the people in the accounting functions within Enron came from Arthur Andersen. Also, the billings between Andersen and Enron were so high that it was very easy for Arthur Andersen to put a favorable, to look at these transactions through rose-colored glasses. Keep in mind that Arthur Andersen's Houston office was making $1 million a week in professional fees from Enron.
Holy Moses.
And their law firm was making $500,000 a week in legal fees at the Millennium. So it was, and it's not as if, by the way, it's not as if the people at Arthur Andersen didn't have questions. It's just that those questions weren't really brought to Enron management. One of my favorite people asked me, for example, well, what advice do you give boards of directors now, having looked at this? And well, I have lots of them, but one that's very, very practical question is when the finance committee or the audit committee meets with the your auditing firm for the end of the year review, a very important question to ask is, what have you folks discussed amongst yourselves that you haven't brought to us? Because there's evidence in the Enron case that actually there were a lot of doubts amongst the Arthur Andersen experts
mm-hmm.
about what was going on. But somehow they never really brought that to the directors. And the directors claimed, and I think rightly claimed, you know, that they can't be responsible for things that they were never told.
Well, and that's true.
Yeah,
that's
and that is
true.
Very true.
That
and so
true.
To a large extent, the directors, and I probably should have made this point at the front end, there was a lot of just plain being misled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so if you're men and women of goodwill, you know, I mean, it really takes a very special person, you know, to smell a fish, you know.
Well, I think, too, when you do smell the fish,
yeah.
sometimes you may say, well, maybe I'm just not looking at that fishy situation correctly. Maybe I'm ignorant of something. And I think we've got a five-letter word called trust.
Right.
And when people have that trust, it's very, very difficult to bring forth, especially when you're dealing with the wheelers and dealers, when you have people like Skilling that can talk, you make a statement that somebody said that he could out-argue God.
He's a brilliant man. He's a total
brilliant man. Here you have someone that really is a genius in their own way.
Right, right.
And has this mind that can deal with so many multiples.
Right.
And you may be sitting there just in awe. By the time he gets through talking to you, he goes, well, I'm not sure, but I guess it makes sense. And so you're sort of humbled, and you're a little bit overwhelmed, and it may take you 3 or 4 days to figure out what question you did want to ask in rebuttal to maybe what he was presenting.
Well, you know, that's so true, and I think that's a very important point, and I think you've made it very eloquently. It's also difficult to break that trust in a public setting.
Mm-hmm.
There was one director. He was the CEO of Tektronix Corporation, who was a one-term director, and he was essentially asked to step down because he asked too many negative questions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a question. So trust also is lives in a social context. And then people who look like they might be betraying that trust, you know, are then expelled.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, to some extent, happened at Enron.
Well, I know of situations that I've been privy to relative to individuals that have had corporations, not as big as Enron, but they've had them, where individuals have had particular agendas, and they manage to bounce out the questioning individuals because they were either too close to the money,
mm-hmm.
they knew too much of what was going on, and
mm-hmm.
they couldn't hide what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's different sides to everything, and this is not an absolute black and white.
Well, it's not, and what's so intriguing about this is that the people involved, certainly at the board, were and are AAA people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the process did not serve them well. And then also you have Skilling himself, who in many respects is an extraordinary individual. And by virtue of process, by virtue of sort of the stock market boom, by virtue of the oil patch, you know, mentality, wildcat, you know, mentality,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
they lost their way. And the question is, how do you keep an organization from not losing its way? And how does an organization maintain ethical discipline when one is always in the penumbra between this clear light, or one can wander in to the penumbra between the clear light of right doing and wrong doing?
Malcolm, I'm going to have to interrupt you. Excuse me. We're going to take a break for a moment.
Excellent.
This is Donna Sebo. My special guest today is Malcolm Salter. He is the James J. Hill Professor of Business Administration Emeritus at the Harvard Business School. We're talking about his recent book, Innovation Corrupted, The Origins and Legacy of Enron's Collapse. When we come back, we'll be discussing some other items in more detail. I think you'll find it just as fascinating as I have, and you'll want to be educated about it, because if you're an investor, this is going to give you an inside track on maybe how to make some good evaluations. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Hello. Welcome back. This is Donna Sebo. My special guest today is Malcolm Salter. We're talking about his book, Innovation Corrupted. And before we took our break, and of course this is about the origins and legacy of Enron's collapse, I had brought up a comment about the investor. Malcolm, let's address that, because so frequently the investor is ignored. You had literally millions and millions of dollars of people's hard-earned money that went in to support
right.
this company,
right.
and they ended up with nothing, just
right.
destitute. They were wiped clean.
Right.
Let's address that. What do investors need to look at? What should
well, let me tell you a little story. Okay, again, there is a phenomenon which those of you who have been reading the business press recently have probably picked up, is the phenomenon of the short sellers. Most people like you and me, Donna, buy stocks and hold them for a long period of time,
mm-hmm.
so we try to buy low and sell high, right?
Right.
If we're lucky. Well, then there are the short sellers who basically believe that the price of a stock has gone down. So they sell the stock at, let's say, 100 and then hope to buy it back at 10. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so they make the $90 in between. In the Enron case, there were a lot of people, not a lot, there were a few people who made a ton of money
mm-hmm.
by selling Enron's shares short. In other words, while everybody else was losing their money, they were making money because they sold stock at the equivalent of $100 and were buying it back, you know, at pennies.
Mm-hmm.
So they made an enormous spread. Now, what is it? What do we learn from that? Well, one thing about short sellers, who are extraordinarily gutsy investors, is they have to do a tremendous amount of homework because if they think the stock price is going to go down and it goes up, they lose a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
So the short sellers know how to do their homework. The other thing about short sellers is they are professionally required to be a cynic. That everything that they've been told, they have to say, prove it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when they read the financial statements, they are like spies. They try to X-ray everything. Now, in the Enron case, there were some signals, but we didn't see it. You know, bankers didn't see it. Harvard Business School professors didn't see it.
Why?
Many different groups of people didn't see it.
How come they didn't see it?
Well, some of us did. But do you know why? Because we love in America the next new thing.
That's true.
We love innovation. You know, we love innovation. And during this period of time, we had all these dot-coms going public for billions of dollars, you know, without any revenues. So it was a little bit of the times. But what's important for a short seller is to really be a cynic about what you're reading and try to get underneath what people are telling you. So that, for example, as I talked about before, if a company is reporting a lot of profits, but there's not an awful lot of cash, they're short on cash, what does that mean?
That's a red flag.
That's a big red flag. It means that their profits are basically accruals of something that's going to happen in the future. Okay? But it is not. It's not cash. It's an accounting phenomenon. It's mm-hmm. not real cash. Mm-hmm. So if there's not real cash, that should be a signal. The other thing, which for me was the big signal, very early on, for me, which is the big signal, was that this was a company that never, and it's a technical term, never earned its cost of capital. In other words, when you borrow debt, you pay 6%, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the cost of the equity that's invested in the business has an imputed cost, let's say 10%. So that your cost of capital together is, let's say, 15%. But these guys were only returning, you know, like 6 or 7% on their assets. So one thing I always do, and the short sellers do, they always look at, well, what's the cost of capital, and are they earning their cost of capital? Because if they don't earn enough to pay the cost of their capital, they are basically destroying value. So short sellers get into that kind of technical stuff. So one of the things I always tell my students, you know, in my last lecture, one of my one-liners is always, always speak to the shorts. In other words, always speak to the shorts. In other words, speak to the doubting Thomases. Speak to the happy cynics. So, or as Reagan used to say, you know, President Reagan used to say, trust but verify. And that's a lesson that just has to be learned over and over again. It's a simple lesson.
Absolutely. Well, as we were discussing during the break, this is not something new, but you were bringing up the perverse incentive.
Well, the other thing, yes, the other thing that is so interesting about this case and why it's a marker case that gets to the sort of the risks of 21st century American capitalism is that this is very much a story about perverse incentives, which basically fed this ethical drift over a period of time. And by perverse incentives, there's a whole list, you know, of perverse incentives. But for example, let me give you a case in point. What if I, Donna, gave you a bonus? Let's say this bonus was 5 to 10 times salary.
That's a nice deal.
Okay, based on your estimate of the future, of the present value of future profits from a commodity contract that you signed during a year. So you get a bonus based on the estimated present value of a future flow of profits from a 12-year contract.
Mm-hmm.
What might happen there is you might overestimate the profits in the future. You know, there are no facts about the future.
Mm-hmm.
You may take the present value of the discount rate, which is not an accurate discount rate. That's an example of a perverse incentive, paying somebody up front for money that hasn't yet been earned.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you basically have, if you pay a bonus or stock options without any regard for how your competitors are doing, or how the market is doing. For example, if you're getting paid on the basis of the stock price of the company, your stock price goes up 15% a year, you say, oh, my God, that's terrific. What if the market goes up 15% a year? Basically, you've made no relative returns, right? You just matched the market.
Mm-hmm.
Why should you get a bonus based on that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a perverse incentive. Or another perverse incentive has to do with that performance awards cannot be rescinded when past performance is revised. In other words, I give you a bonus because this has been a good year, but then it turns out it's not such a good year because we have to have write-offs.
Mm-hmm.
I can't either look back or claw back the bonuses I've given to you. That's perverse. Well, that I can go on for 10 more of these. Okay, they were going on at Enron. And by the way, going on at other companies as well. And that really leads to a kind of derelict behavior. It basically rewards lying and cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And misrepresentation. And that is not only an Enron story. It's also a subprime mortgage story. What if I told you that mortgage brokers are paid on commission with no penalty for writing poorly performing home loans?
Oh, that's appalling.
Okay. What if I told you that the financial intermediaries who package and resell home loans as these multi-layered, you know, collateralized loan obligations to investors for a fee, have no accountability for the credit quality of these complex securities.
Now, see, that is the big, that is something that has been very disturbing to me in so many aspects of dealing with and being concerned with the private investor.
Right.
It is as if there is a mentality, we are not going to be held responsible for this.
Right.
This is not our fault. There is no accountability.
Right. And that's a, why it's a perverse incentive. By the way, if I went to Brooks Brothers to buy a jacket, you know, and then the threat unraveled, they'd take it back, right?
Yes.
Well, you can't give back, you know, a collateralized debt obligation.
Mm-hmm.
But to go back to the investor, okay, if you are a happy cynic, you're going to ask the question, who really knows what that credit quality is? Who actually has money on the line or has skin in the game that will, that, in terms of their, of ensuring the credit quality? One Standard Moore's and Moody's, you know, makes its, you know, its judgment. No one judges it. But how do they know that they're right?
And on
the
that
volume
question,
of this business is enormous. Have they looked at every loan? No.
Right. We're going to take a break here for just a moment. We'll come back, and I knew that this hour we would just—it was just so much information, and
yes,
this book is just great. We'll be coming back in just a moment. Donna Sebo here with my special guest, Malcolm Salter. Innovation Corrupted: The Origins and Legacy of Enron's Collapse. More to come. We'll be back. Just a moment.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo. My special guest today, James J. Hill, Professor of Business Administration Emeritus at the Harvard Business School, is Malcolm Salter. His wonderful book is Innovation Corrupted. This hour has been dedicated to this because I think the positioning of ethics in business and so much of what our country has been going through, the U.S., but also throughout the world, we're seeing so much on the news daily. Malcolm, can you tell us what the legacy of Enron, and I know it's probably going to be much bigger than what we would expect at this moment, but as a teacher of business, you were just using the information in class recently.
And yes, we spent 2 days at the Harvard Business School on Enron.
Okay, so there you are. So what is the legacy? And what would you as a teacher tell to someone that wants to go into business, wants to be in business classes? What do they need to know?
Well, there are two technical and one general legacy issues. The two technical ones have to do around financial incentives for executives, which I think were perverse in this case, and are perverse in a wide sense within the economy today. Not every company, but many companies. I think there are also legacy issues with respect to board oversight, how to improve board oversight. But the more general one has to do with ethical discipline. and that is, how do you live in a world where you, where the rules are never clear, and the intent of the rules and the laws also are sometimes hard to fathom? And that is really how we live in that zone is really going to spell the future for American capitalism, because if we lose trust in markets, they will collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how do we live in that zone? And the way you live in that zone in a productive way is to basically keep reviewing these borderline decisions, both as a management team and as a board, just taking case after case, whether it's an advertising or whether it's a new product introduction or whether it's an accounting problem, every year, take those borderline issues and just study them so you can kind of flesh out the values of your own organization, and so you know where the borderline is between what you think is acceptable and unacceptable. Other than that, I think what's really important and what I tell my students is that being a business person today is basically a continual exercise in moral deliberation. And as a matter of fact, all my and people ask me what I've done for 40 years, where I can tell you all the classes and all the wonderful stuff that I've taught, but it really gets down to, once you learn the technical stuff, what do you do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And the moral deliberation issues are very, very important, because you cannot in business serve everybody's interests at one time. It's like a multivariable equation. You can't solve for all variables at once. So the moral issue every day is, whose issues do you serve in which order? And if you systematically expropriate value from any of your constituency groups, at some point you will be taken out. I guarantee you. So then the question becomes, how do you make those decisions? Well, that's where experience, that's where mentors, and that's where questions of fairness come in. And being aware of the fact that no individual can do that in a large organization for himself or herself on her own requires, from a leadership point of view, or whether it's a department or whether it's a plant or whether it's a firm, that you support individuals as a group in making moral decisions by going through these reenactments and discussions of these close calls, to find out where that shadow line is that makes, unless you confront it, you'll never find it. So you have to make ethics discussable rather than undiscussable. And that in so many companies, there's so many other things going on that it doesn't get the time it needs. So for young people going into business, recognize that it's not all about making money. That's sort of a byproduct. But to be successful, you will be judged on the kind of the moral decisions that you make. Because fundamentally, when it's all well and done, when the lawyers leave the room, most important stuff is done on a handshake.
Mm-hmm. That's the better word, trust.
And you lose that trust, you never, ever get it back.
It's a long process.
It's a long process. Your rehabilitation is a very long process. So that would be that's sort of my message on that one here, is to recognize what the act of management, you know, is about. And that therefore creating companies and creating businesses is an extraordinarily creative process.
Mm-hmm.
Because it involves the technology, it involves organizational capability, but it involves the integrity to bring resources to the enterprise. Human resources, great human resources. Great people don't want to work for people who are jerks.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, you'll never raise a nickel unless people believe in you.
That is absolutely true. Well, this has been a marvelous hour. Malcolm Salter, thank you very much for being my guest. Your book, Innovation Corrupted, I recommend it for any of you that would like to see a very well-examined picture of a company, not the only one that's had failings, but a company, and how leadership makes a difference. But it's not just the leadership. It's so many other factors that are involved in creating a company that holds its integrity first and foremost, and service to its shareholders first and foremost in their mission and in their level of accomplishment. Again, Malcolm, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Excellent.
This is Donna Sebo. We are out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Don't forget, tomorrow we're talking wind power. Same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. And don't forget, if you enjoyed this show and you want your friends to hear this interview, all they have to do is go to the archives. We'll see you again tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.